about 10 years ago. Yeah, at least. You're talking about the board. It was an organization that exists for disabled people, and they really wanted Frank to be upgraded to a computerized communication device. Like all my life, people K-E kept P-U pushing H-I high tech on me N-E never W it never worked.
Really?
Yeah, so Frank was reluctant to go along with the communication thing, and he asked if he could try it first, and they said, no, you have to just, like, you know, they were buying it for him. It was, like, multi-thousands of dollars, and so they said, no, we'll just get it. You'll love it, and they got it.
And they got it.
They got it for him. They paid for it. We had to go to Stanford, and they did this whole fancy-dancy, you know, checking them up and all this. Hi. This is Kirsten.
Hi, Kirsten.
This is Deborah and Ignacio.
I think I've seen you somewhere before.
It's all familiar to him.
It's all familiar, yes.
I live in Berkeley, so.
Okay, yeah.
He lives in Berkeley, too.
He recognized this room, too, when he came in. Yeah.
That's something weird.
But.
That's funny. Deja vu.
Yeah. But he doesn't have a television, so we figured it's not BTV.
It's not BTV, no.
Yeah. So they get him the device, and it was, so it had a printout and it had a voice output. And what happens now, you'll notice when Frank's pointing to things, there's, like, I'll guess, you know, he'll point, like, to two letters.
Amazing
or something.
Yeah,
and people, after talking to him just for a little bit, will start doing that, too. It's just kind of natural when it seems obvious. But with this I-N-T-I intimate, there's an intimacy about it. But with this, with the newer one, nobody guessed because they just wait for the printout or the voiceovers, the voice output. So Frank had to spell out every single word of every single sentence. So he had to work a lot harder.
Huh.
And I H A had to H I. Oh, he had to hit the keys right in the middle. Like, whereas this, he doesn't have to.
Right.
But the R E, the real R E, the real reason why he didn't like it is because it upstaged him. People were more fascinated with the gadget than they were with what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
So didn't care for that.
Well, that's a legitimate reason.
Yeah. Yeah. H I high tech is great, is G, is glamorous.
Not anymore. Not anymore. I don't find it glamorous anymore. I find something like this. Kind of sexy, interesting, glamorous.
He liked hearing that.
Yeah. No, but it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, how many more gadgets do you?
Right.
You kind of expect the next iteration. You know, it was dreamed.
Right.
Maybe 200 years ago.
Right.
And they just got the plastics to do it now. It's just it's nothing.
Yeah.
So great.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. S. So, that is Why? U. G. O. Got. In. To. Trouble.
I guess so.
Ultimately, yeah.
Yeah. I guess so. Didn't fall in love with it, yeah?
No, not with the technology.
I guess that's it.
But why did you become a scientist in the first place? Oh, is if you don't like technology.
Because
well, he's a biologist.
They're not number one. Number one.
Yeah, well, it's life, not the technology.
And number two, science and technology are not sometimes connected, but absolutely not the same thing.
How? How not?
Because I think science is a way of being, a way of relating to the world, and sometimes it produces gadgets. Sometimes it produces things that have buttons and have levers that do things. But sometimes it doesn't. I really believe there is science that can produce, that can tell you not to do things, not to produce those machines.
It can produce understanding.
Right. I mean, if you're pushing for understanding, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What K.I. kind of B is S C scientist? What kind of science? What kind of being is a scientist, or is science? What kind of being is science?
Is that the question?
Yes.
What kind of being is science? Is science a being?
You said a way of being.
Oh, a way of being. Yeah. Yes. A way of being in doubt, I guess, right? A way of living, questioning, a way of not really believing and asking the next question and asking the next question over and over. Isn't it?
But that is P U pure science.
I don't think there's a difference between pure and applied. I really don't. I think, especially if you separate science and technology, right? As I believe, realize that science does not necessarily produce technology, then, you know, it might not, it might have some great application, it might not, but in the end, everything is really basic because you're just radical. You go to the roots, I guess.
What is radical?
Radical, it goes to the roots, that looks for the roots, that goes to the roots, that deals with the roots or is willing to look at, as opposed to someone who just takes that for granted and builds from higher up, and you don't question deeper. I don't know.
Is you know, true. S is science. L I N linear.
Is science linear? No. No, it can't be. Just like history cannot be linear. I mean, otherwise you would have an end of science, right? There are people who would believe in it.
R Are we A, at the E, end?
The end of what? No. No, there will be science as long as there are people.
U, N, under, ground.
If need be, it will go underground and it will, I mean, people will ask questions and they will be taking all their tools away and their labs will be taken over by corporations and their, I mean, and all these people will, you know, lose their heads and so on, but there will still be someone who will be willing to ask the questions and, you know, and start, I think it's just basic humanity, I think. So no, we're not at the end, and I cannot imagine an end of science. What do you believe?
Yes.
That's a good belief. Yes.
It is. Like A R T. It's like art.
Mm-hmm. 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 I have been dealing a lot with artists recently. And you find that a lot of the art that could have been done in a lab and so on has been pushed back to the underground of artists and people like that.
Yes. Like P A Paul I N Pauline Oliveras? No, Pauline. No. Emma. Mark Pauline. Mark Pauline is R E really a scientist.
Mm.
Do you know who that is? Mm. Is that the guy that builds the machines
yes.
that destroy themselves?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, that's kind of, I think that technology is overwhelming science. And that's sort of what he's doing is kind of reversing that process. He builds these machines that are kind of robotic, and they end up destroying themselves.
Hmm.
They end up fighting with other machines, deconstructing themselves.
I've just heard of them, never seen them.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. Yeah, he does do that. Yeah, he's a mix of art and anti-science almost.
But is he confronting technology or science?
Technology.
Right.
But to do that, he uses SC. Science.
Well, I think that's what's happening in science today, is that the machines are destroying, I mean, we've created tools to create machines which are now sort of kind of separating themselves from the human element. I mean, you know, the technology has so much power to it that it's kind of eliminating the humans. You know, it's destroying, that's kind of...
Transforming?
Or just kind of just the machine is controlling the person rather than the person's being able to have control over the machine.
Mm-hmm.
The whole machinery of it, like the whole biotech thing, is the machine is in charge.
But the M A the machine is not the one who is L I M I T limiting science and A and art
The machine is not the one limiting science and art.
Like, when I S.T. started using C computers. Oh, people gave you a hard time? Is that what you... people gave you a hard time? Because Frank, as a performer and as an artist, is known for being his very humanness of trying to create environments where people come together and experience their connectiveness with each other. So, and then when he started getting into computers, before most of the people, most of our friends were... he was really criticized by, you know, so now what's going to happen? What happened to the whole thing about being personal and physical and all that, and you're doing computers? And their assumption was that he would fall in line with the characteristics or the character of a computer, whereas what he did was he used the computer to create a community online, which then would get together in person and created an intimacy online. That's so then they, of course, years later backed off on the criticism. But
I'm about to say something that I don't know how comfortable I feel with.
Guess you better say it then.
Yeah, better not say it. Better not say it.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no. I think you...
Don't have me be beg.
No, it's...
T-A, take the R, take the risk.
Yes, but it's not about not saying something. It's about finding the words to say it right without. But I. I do believe that you can use technology and you can use things. I really like what I've been hearing so far of intimacy. Of how you can actually develop even more intimacy. The rhythm of your board, for example, the rhythm of this conversation becomes so different.
Yes.
And it's mediated by this thing.
Yes.
And just like that, I can see how, I mean, I know that, for example, the internet, the world of the internet has a totally different rhythm and dynamics that in some ways can become, is more intimate. My relationships with so many people are so different. And the reason why I hesitate to say this is because I know what I'm saying is technology is neutral and it depends on how you what you use it for and so on, and you can use it. And that's such a huge trap. Because it's also true that technology has all these demons embedded in it, right?
Yes.
That we cannot deny.
Yes. Always, even every T, E, C.
Technology
has its demons.
Has its demons.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like L A N language L I limits us in to L I linear.
Yeah.
S. So, you have to are T A take that in to a account and F I find P O E T R poetry W H I which gets A around the limits. Then T E technology is H U human.
Right. I totally agree with that. That's, if we are to talk about biotechnology, then I think that might be why biotechnology is not amenable to that, because it really is not. You cannot account for it. You cannot be responsible for it. I guess that's part of what you're saying, that word responsibility is such a weird one, but...
Yes. R-E-R-E-S responsibility C-O comes with C-R-E A
creativity.
Right.
It's true.
Creativity. I'm trying to think. I'm trying to think of how much creativity there really is in the throwing genes at an organism and just seeing what happens. It's so much more to do with chance, random chance, and a bet that a corporation will buy that thing that comes out of that.
And why you are T-H threatening, no, T-H-R, O, W,
throwing. Genes.
Yes.
Yeah, that's my question. Why?
Like, if it is B, E, because of C. You are I curiosity that would be one, that would be one thing, but if it for if it is for P, no, if it is for
power.
P, power, no.
No.
Yes.
Power.
Power, or P, R, profit. That's another thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And if it... L I limits S C science to J just the S E A search for
profit.
Profit.
I think that's what we're seeing. I think that's what we're seeing, at least in biotech. That the whole this science, which there must have been at some point behind it, is really imploding, collapsing in itself, and just creating these monstrous institutions and objects that come out of it. I think there must have been some science behind it at some point, but I think it is really collapsing and kind of imploding on itself. We see those contradictions more and more. And then the question becomes how those contradictions actually affect the non-human, the not us, because on that is different. It's much more like explosives or like things like that.
You are the G. You're the guy who F. O found that GMO corn FRO from the US mm-hmm. was contaminating the Mexican corn.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But asking a question and that's for example asking a question that had no technology as a consequence, and it's just making a statement of a fact of something that is out there of this, you know, these beings that are being churned out of this totally catastrophic and self-contradicting industry. I don't know what to call it, because it's such a hybrid itself. University, the industry, the government, so what they call government, all together. And I think all we did was the equivalent of taking a Polaroid picture of something and just show it. That's all.
How did C-O-R corn J-U jump the border?
You tell them.
Well, they sold it. The Americans sold it to Mexico for less than the price of producing it in Mexico. They sold it at their government stores, and people bought it. And in Mexico, when people buy corn, they plant some, they eat some, and they plant some. And no one told them not to plant it, even though GMO corn was against the law to plant it. But it wasn't identified as GMO when they bought it in the store. So they bought it and they planted it, and then it crossed with the land race corn and Ignacio figured that would happen sooner or later, and it turned out it happened a lot sooner than he thought it would. But the people planting it didn't know. And I think probably the corporations knew that would happen.
They must have known.
I mean, because that's what they do there. That's what the farmers do. They in Oaxaca, in the mountains, they plant, they eat some and they plant some. They've always done.
You know, the trigger for me to finally ask David, my student, to go with the primers to amplify those sequences and identify, was that I was working for the National Academy of Sciences, a committee that was supposed to be looking at the scientific foundations for how it is that we don't regulate these plants. In the U.S., we don't regulate them. The USDA deregulates them. So you produce one of these beings, and you want to put it out, and you just ask USDA for a permit, and they just give it to you, and that's it. Never, no questions asked, no follow up, nothing. And so, you know, being in a committee of supposedly scientists who are supposed to be asking the scientific basis for this decision, I said, well, I would like to ask the question: What will happen when we see these genes and this piece of DNA and these organisms moving to places like the centers of origin and diversification of our crops. And we were told we should not ask that question. You know, very clearly, the answer came down.
Who told you that?
The study was being paid by USDA itself. So it was USDA who had this veto power to say, thou shalt not ask this question. There were two questions that I asked, and both of them were kind of vetoed off the table. And, you know, I didn't resign in disgust because that committee had good people who were going to say good things.
But why would the government tell you not to ask those questions if is not the GO? Isn't the government PR protecting us?
That's a long story. I think we know that's what the answer to that is.
That's what your movie is about.
Yeah, that's what my
film
is about.
Tell about the revolving door or something.
Well, when you really look at genetically modified crops and how they got approved, you find that people come from industry into the government, into the positions that regulate these things, and decided that there would be no regulation. Then they go back to Monsanto, back to the government, no regulation, back to Monsanto. They go back and forth and back and forth. So the scientists from the FDA said they should be tested and they should be controlled. But the top people who aren't scientists would come into the top of the agencies and just rubber stamp them through. And they're declared, the thing about genetically modified crops are they're considered substantially equivalent to non-genetically modified crops. And therefore, they're considered safe, so they're not labeled or not tested, even though they're totally different. So that's what the government declared it. A long time ago, Dan Quayle, and you know, there was a real deliberate effort for these things to get under the radar and planted and all over in millions of acres, and so it would be considered a done deal.
We, then, they, S.A., say, D A R darn.
Yeah, yeah.
It is too late.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Or they say, great, it's too late.
Yeah.
Or darn. Yeah. Gosh. Yeah. That's what they're saying now because they've recently done tests and found that in the seed supply that's supposed to be non-GMO is filled with genetically modified seeds.
Certified seed that's supposed to not be GMO.
That's supposed to not be GMO, yeah, is filled with it. And so they're saying it, they're trying to say it's too late.
But and then they say they own the C R O crop crops that were contaminated.
Right. Right.
That's the other part of your movie.
That's the other part. That they're patented. And the corporations that have patented the gene, they patent the gene and the crops, whatever the gene is in, they own. They actually, when the farmers plant this, they actually don't buy the seed. They lease the seed from the corporation, and they plant the crop. Yeah, so they come on your land and see that their patented material is there and take it off and sue you a year later.
But in C.A. Canada, a guy... Percy?
Our friend Percy.
I was with him
yesterday.
Ignacio
was just with him in Mexico. Yeah, we went to Canada. We filmed him in the film. Yeah, he fought back.
He did not P L play
plant
their seeds, but it D R drifted to his land. S. So they said
they sued him.
I think if anybody's watching this, or you know, over the next few and the next weeks and months, I think it's really important for people to know that this decision is being taken. You know, this whole thing is in the hands of the Supreme Court of Canada right now. And they are deciding. They really are deciding. A group of how many judges? I don't know.
Are there nine
in Canada? Might be nine.
I don't know.
They are deciding whether one can own life, and whether one can, through introducing one piece of DNA into an organism, own the organism, its descendants, and its all the different forms that it might take into the future. It's really incredible, and very few people know that this is happening. Why? Because it's happening to a farmer in Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm. B. A. Basically, they want the M.O. money. No, monopoly. No, monopoly on F. food.
What do you get if you have...
Yeah,
well, you
true.
Have to have monopoly on food and monopoly on the seed. Because you can... very close to monopoly on food, right?
Yeah, well, they bought... Monsanto spent $8 billion buying up all the seed companies. Almost all the seeds in America are owned by four clusters of companies. They bought up all the seeds, and then they can hold them back and only give out the ones that are genetically modified that they patented and they own. Yeah, it's really frightening.
In the end, it has become, because there is such little creativity behind it, really there is very little creativity, it has become a simple brand.
Mm.
You know, it's an internal brand that you carry and you pass on to your descendants so that you can be identified as the property of these four companies. That's mm-hmm. that's what it is now. Very little use, very few applications, and the applications that they're dreaming of. I mean, the amazing thing is, it would give you the power to dream of so many things, and the things they dream of are so boring and so useless. It's just incredible.
It's so frightening.
And
like.
Yeah.
When it F A I
fails.
We will be in
debt.
Deep trouble.
Deep trouble. Yeah. B E because the F A M the families.
Famine.
Famine will be G L O global, not L local.
Local.
And because we won't have the resources to confront it. We won't have the people who know what to do. We won't have the genetic resources to bring into the crops, to whatever, you know, it might be drought, it might be locust, it might be a fungal disease or viral disease, whatever, we don't know. And the only way to confront that is with genetic resources and cultural resources to deal with it. And that's exactly what we're eroding here. I think that's it.
You know, and I don't think most people understand that. You know, when people talk about diversity, we need diversity. In crops and things, I don't think they understand why. But you explained that really well. That whole land race thing.
you explain it?
You can explain it, but you do that really well, because most people don't.
It's such a buzzword, but we don't often hear an actual intellectual discussion about the virtues of diversity in terms of real life survival.
Yeah, it's not just because it's a nice idea. Right. It is a nice idea, right. But there's actually other deeper reasons for it biologically, right. Which...
You can speak to
Professor Chappelle taught me, so.
No, I don't know what to say.
Or?
Well.
I will.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
But I am L A. I'm lazy.
Lazy. You don't look
you
lazy.
Might,
I don't
might
think
be
you're
slow,
lazy.
But you're not lazy.
But you know
I can tell this is a lot of work.
But you know, I think the best the easiest example to use for people to understand that is the Irish potato famine, where they were growing one kind of potato, and when the blight hit Ireland, that potato that potato, you know, was all the potatoes were diseased, and people starved because there was nothing else, and they had to go back to Peru and find a potato that would withstand the blight and bring it back to Ireland and replant. But that's the thing of growing a monoculture.
Right.
And then you can't, if the diversity is gone, you can't go to these places like Oaxaca or Peru or these where they have the original things like wheat. I don't even think there is any land-raised wheat anymore. Where is it? It's in Iraq.
Yeah, well, it's around the Fertile Crescent. And
I mean, it's even there.
Yeah.
But so if we can't go back and find these types that will withstand different diseases and insects, then what are you gonna grow?
And if you are a B E T I betting person P you put all your money on it will fail.
You know, yeah. I would like to go back to the biology, but it's already failed financially. If you think of betting and, you know, money wise things, it's already failed. It's been 25 years of this bet that, you know, back then Dan Quayle and Bush the First had on this, which was kind of reasonable, but it has failed so badly that the industry. I just read recently an analysis from a financial firm, Ernst & Young, and they say that they have invested, there has been an investment of $220 billion. And for nothing. They are not making money.
In ag biotech?
Yeah, in biotech in general.
Mm.
But they're not making money. So it's already failed in that sense. Now, the worrisome part of it is that it's still going with its own inertia, I mean, that huge inertia. And now we should be talking about the biological failure.
Should be jumping the train, which is headed for the crash.
Yeah.
But
jumping off.
That is the C O M M O common M I M I O no M O D model the N U nuclear is a F failure, but
we're still pushing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The C A R, the car, is a failure, but they're still pushing that.
But at least the car makes these people rich, because we're stupid enough to buy cars, right? These things, these biotechnological developments, are not even doing that. I think nuclear is similar, in that it's not really You know, it's not really economically viable either. But there are very few things like that where we've been so stubborn, so, you know, wild-eyed invested into something. I think in history, I don't know.
H, E, hey. H, E, R, B, A, herbs, W, work, M, much better than a lot of the pharmaceutical drugs they're based upon, but you can not M make money.
You can't patent herbs.
You can't patent them and make money.
Well, they've tried.
Right.
They keep trying. They keep trying to use either patents or plant variety protection or copyright sometimes to try and, you know, the neem tree and the yellow beans and the...
That's true. They are trying to do that, aren't they?
The high content, high oil content maize that DuPont has just, you know, just put, got a patent. The amazing thing is the patent offices give you a patent on all any maize that has a certain level of oil and above that level. No matter who produces it, no matter that's...
They have that patent now, no matter what if it's...
They got it from the European Patent Office, and the Mexican government is fighting like hell, and I think they're winning.
Oh, my God.
There's another one that was issued in the U.S. For yellow beans, again, Mexican yellow beans. So then any bean that has a certain hue of yellow on it is going to be owned by these guys.
Did they challenge that? Did they hear the case? You know, that story of the Mexican yellow beans, an American went down to Mexico to the market. I think it was Oaxaca. Mm-hmm.
In Sonora,
he got a bunch of yellow beans that they've been growing in Mexico for generations, took them back to the United States, patented them so that Mexico couldn't export them to the United States anymore because
N-D-I, Indian, R-I,
rice.
Rice.
Right, basmati rice.
Basmati rice, did they patent that?
They tried,
but they didn't get to, yeah.
But again, that is another one that's falling, you know, collapsing in itself. Patent system. The golden rice, I'm sure you've heard about golden rice, which was what Michael Pollan calls the first rhetorical technology to try and cover up and give some hope to consumers that there would be something coming from biotechnology. But nobody can plant it because when they tried, they thought about planting it in the Philippines, they discovered that there were over 50 different patents and licenses crossing over this pure, poor little grain. So that if you dare put it in the ground, you risk being sued by at least 49 of them if you own one.
Oh, my God.
So nobody dares put this seed on the ground and grow it.
But wasn't that just a big fraud anyway? Because didn't you have to eat 14 pounds a day to get vitamin A, enough vitamin A to justify it?
Right.
Yes.
I mean, it was
a
big hype, and I don't even think that hasn't everyone pulled back from that?
It's not being, for all these different reasons. It's just a rhetorical technology. I think it's
a
very
good
way of putting it. They just wanted to have the front page of Time magazine, which they did.
That's what they got.
S. So. Why. Are. They. Doing. It.
Big pyramid scheme.
Yeah. And momentum.
I have been told by colleague scientists, where I really refuse to put, you know, to play the stocks, especially if it was stocks in things that I know, you know, that I deal with, you know. But everybody, of course, would buy into it. Okay, somebody, you know, my colleague over there is starting a venture capital, a new company. Why don't we buy stock into it? Support your friend, and also, you know, it might do well. And the way they put it, and I've had this more than twice told to me, is, look, Ignacio, all you need to do is believe that there are 10 people who are more stupid than you are. I guess if you made it to be a professor at Berkeley, it's a relatively safe bet. Just go with it. There will be 10 people who are more stupid than you are behind you, and then you know,
that will buy
problem.
The stock.
Yeah,
buy
when
the stock after
you will
it's
be
run
a
out.
Little bit more informed. You will know see. When to jump when out.
See. See why. Cynical. Will. K. Kill. Kill us. Cynicism will kill us.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. So what do you do against cynicism?
Give people an alternative.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. You cannot just confront them with negative, negative, negative all the time, which is what you do so well in that movie, I think. I know that you've been working on it really hard to not be just negative.
To give people a way out.
Yeah.
Feel like they're
don't
empowered.
Put them in a corner.
Their understanding can lead them to take some actions that'll, you know, make them feel like they're helping.
Like we have F-O are forced our local the natural grocery to deal with the GMO issue.
Great.
They didn't want to, and there is
that?
So the name of the place.
Yeah.
Are we naming names? Frank?
Is it the one down up the street?
Berkeley Natural
yeah.
Grocery, and owned by the same person as El Cerrito Natural Grocery.
They
and
didn't want to deal with it?
They didn't
no.
want to think about it?
No, they it took so much pressure from the employees to after we did A-L-A-P-O-S, a poster. Well, we had written a couple of letters as, you know, we buy all our food there and have for like over 10 years. And we told them how much money we've spent, you know, and that I have a spy in the store. One of Frank's students works there.
Oh.
Frank was instrumental in getting him the job years back. And so we have the inside word on what's going on. We had written them a couple of letters complaining. Well, at that point, it was complaining about ingredient changes. As the corporations were buying up all the little companies, the ingredients in the products that we had bought for years were changing, but nobody mentioned it. So instead of molasses in our hot chocolate, there was sugar. And one day, I look at the package, and I said, there's sugar in our hot chocolate. I was outraged.
Yeah.
That's what started it. And then when our spy started making inquiries, it turned out that it was happening all throughout the store, and then we discovered that it was as the multinationals were buying up these small companies, it was cheaper to so Frank had him do up a whole paper, this was on the sugar issue, and present it to the owner, because they started knocking out taking off the shelves barley malt and molasses and replacing it with organic white sugar. It's all the same. You know, that's what they would say. So we did a long paper on how it biologically and all that stuff, how it wasn't the same. And, you know, they were going to address it, but they never did. And then, you know, skip forward a couple of years or so, and then all of a sudden the GMO thing is start to come up.
Wow.
So again, another letter asking them if they would if they are unwilling to stop carrying the items, would they at least identify them for people who care?
Right.
And didn't get an answer to that letter. And so we made up a sign, and we were prepared to stand out in front of that store with our sign, something about this natural grocery store isn't natural if it carries GMO or something like that.
Right.
And within days of our making that sign, we L E A leaked.
Leak.
We leaked it to the owner that we were ready to boycott the store. And so all of a sudden he decides to create a GMO team.
Wow.
Small circle of employees that were very fired up about it. And we're using like Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco as a model.
Oh, yeah.
And so he begrudgingly said they could have so many paid hours a week, which, you know, when they'd ask for it, they'd have to fight to get the hours.
Yeah.
To do the research.
Hours were to research, to get in touch with all the companies, to put out the word to other natural groceries that they were starting this campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To present to the manufacturers that people care about what's in their products. And hundreds of stores around the country have signed on.
Wow. And you started it.
Yeah.
This is just on the GMO thing.
And the owner is starting to get all this press on the front of a big magazine.
Right. So everybody now wants to do interviews. He's happy now, yeah.
But what happens is that the employees are very, you know, there's a little mini revolution going because they watch him taking credit. He rarely mentions that they're doing the work. Rarely.
Uh-huh.
And if he does, it's very little. And they still have to fight to get their hours. And, you know, some of them have been working without getting paid because they're so into it.
Right.
They take their hours whether he'll give them their paid hours or not.
Wow.
Frank said, no, you don't do that. You demand the paid hours.
Yeah. Well, so. Health food stores, that's the last... I mean, you know, that should be the citadel of non-GMO stuff. That's where their value is. That's where the money is, you know. Because that's where people are going to be going for
it. You would think that would be obvious.
Yeah, you would think it would be obvious. Yeah. You would think that.
We, P, E, people don't understand. U, S, E, use, L, logic.
Yeah.
No, true.
They take the easy way.
And yet, you know... The tide is rising, really. I mean, obviously must know about Mendocino this week.
Yes. You should say, though.
You say it.
They passed a law, I guess. It's a measure. To ban GMO from Mendocino.
Planting them from the county.
Planting or having animals. It's animals and plants.
Animals and plants. Yeah. Animals. Oh. Yeah. Oh, that's good. Yeah. I'm glad they added that. Yeah. It's now
illegal to grow or have, you know, they have now the ability to pull up a crop and even put someone in jail if they do. So it's the first GMO-free area of the Americas, I think.
I think it's the first time citizens have actually voted on it.
Yeah.
I think legislatures have voted on it in other countries, but this is the first time citizens have done it. And it passed by a pretty good margin. Was it
56 to, I don't know, just under 50.
Even when the biotech people, didn't they put a lot of money into trying to defeat it? Oh,
yeah. They put over $600,000 into it, and all of the money came from out of state, except for a tiny little bit. And I think they spent $50 per voter.
Right.
And all of their mailings came from out of state.
It's very, very encouraging.
Every single, no local people, no money was spent locally. I mean, it all came from out of state, and that was just the wrong thing to do. I mean, they were that was just insulting to the people up there.
Well, to me, the
people, the pro-H people spent 80,000. 80 versus over 600,000.
The interesting comparison, one of the interesting comparisons is what happened last year in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Where they try to get a much simpler, much more palatable thing, which is just have a label, which amazing. Yes. We shouldn't have labels, and they got defeated, and I think that tells me what scale things can work. Mm-hmm. You know, we both participated and we were invited to go and talk, and I was invited to go and talk in Mendocino for the Measure H. And you can see that they were relying on eye contact and how many hands you can shake. And there's no money that can bust that. Whereas you get to the state level and, real big money politics start.
We, people don't you
understand
C-H-A-N change C-O comes W-I with in S-M small they think it has to be huge, big numbers to make it anything that will affect change.
I think in Mendocino the change happened person by person. Ignacio spoke up there a few times and they showed my film, which is about GMOs, and it wasn't even finished yet. And they must have shown it at least 15 or 20 times. They showed it at the Methodist Church, at the sophomore biology class, at people's barns in their living room. And we made the film so it wasn't just to, preach to the choir, but so that anybody could see it and understand it. And there were one of the original people who saw the film, and my friend took it to him to see, is a vintner, a big rancher up there who's, in his 70s, and, I don't think he's not liberal or anything, and he was for GMOs, and then he saw the film, and he said, we have to stop this, I'm going to vote for the measure, and he came out in the newspaper for it, and he was very influential, he'd been a supervisor, and a lot of people saw what he'd thought, but it was not just because it's the film, but because it gave the information about it, because people understood what it meant, and a lot of people who would describe themselves as right wing saw this. Well, they understood the issues, and they changed their mind and decided to ban the GMOs, which means it's not really, it's not a radical issue. It's a human issue.
B. E. Because it. They. E. A. Because they eat.
Because they eat. Exactly. Exactly. That's right.
Right.
It's a very human thing.
That's where it hits. I think if you scrub the environment with your gut, right? You kind of put the environment through your gut, and so that's where it starts feeling that way. The other place is the uterus, I think. Where if anybody has a uterus, they should have, and they immediately sense there's something weird about. what we're releasing out there, I think it's true.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
U A also F O found G GMOs B O U N bounce W
within the genome. Yeah, that's something that is being developed. It's a story that is still growing, but yes, you're right. Okay, just very technically, you cannot move a gene from one place to the other, from one organism that was wearing that gene and put it into another one as if it was just a jigsaw puzzle pieces because it doesn't work. That's one of the big myths that they keep repeating over and over and over. I'm going to take surgically, I'm going to take this little piece here and put it over here. It's not true. We just grab a chunk and then you have to mix it with other pieces of DNA before it will actually take this other place. What are those other pieces of DNA about? Well, they come from bacteria, they come from viruses that have evolved over millions of years to do the job of inserting pieces of DNA into other longer pieces of DNA. you know, and splicing themselves in there and doing it. That's why we use them. That's why we use them as vectors and so on. Well, we shouldn't be surprised when these pieces of DNA continue to do the thing that they have been selected to do over millions of years when you put them in place. You use them first to make this DNA jumpy, and then you expect that it will stop jumping. So as the more we look, and there are other groups that I think are following this story much better than we can technically, the more we find this is actually happening.
What? H A happened when they B what happens when they bounce?
We don't know.
It's unpredictable.
By definition.
It's unpredictable. But I think the thing that most people don't understand about this, about GMOs, is that it's a cell invasion technology, that they use viruses and bacteria to insert these the DNA that they want into the cells of whatever they're engineering. And so people are getting bacteria and viruses and all kinds of things in every cell of these GMOs. They're not the same at all. I mean, and people realize that. And then they kind of look at what they're eating and they think, what am I eating?
Yeah.
Who knows? You know,
Terje Travik, who is a very, very serious virologist, who was a gung-ho pro-GMO guy until a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, in Norway. He has a big lab, very successful, you know, royal professor of this or that, in the School of Medicine. He just last week, 10 days ago, made an announcement that they have been working for many years following the DNA that was inserted into the crop through the gut and into the organism in rats. So what they would do is they would feed a single dose of GMO food to these rats, and then they tear them apart and look at all the organs and try and find that DNA, those organs and the cells. They announced about 10 days ago that they are finding the DNA traveling from the food into the gut lining cells, and then after about 3 days and then into 30 days, going all the way to the liver. They find them in the lymph nodes, and they find it in the liver.
Ew.
So, you know, but it's again little Polaroid pictures of a story that we cannot see, that we don't know much about, and the more pictures we see, the more, you know, the uglier it looks.
And you can not get N-O-N
money.
Non-GMO.
Oh, no.
L-E-C, lettuce. Is it lettuce? No, G.
Lecithin.
Lecithin.
I think you can. I think you can, but I think you have to look for it. I've seen it. You can see this as non-GMO lecithin in it. They have like candy bars that, you know, organic candy bars that say no GMOs. They announce it. But yeah, if you went into a regular store and got most stuff that would be
even
GMO.
In O R organic.
You think so?
Well, let's see. I think it was the organic lecithin they couldn't find, but they got companies to say that they could guarantee that the lecithin wasn't GMO. I think that was what happened.
Huh. Because I look for those things.
Maybe Corey, do you can you set us straight on what you found out?
He's the spy.
Oh, I see.
And he's listening. So I'll see if he says anything. We M A make B bread. Oh, that was that when Right. That was because we use lecithin in the bread that we make.
Uh-huh.
And so that was the thing of trying to find lecithin
that you could just buy. Yeah.
That we could buy organic is what we were looking for.
You couldn't find it?
No, we couldn't find it. And still haven't, but we found some that they say is non-GMO.
Get Ignacio to test it for you. Mm. Yeah, lecithin. That's in everything.
That's in everything.
All kinds of stuff.
Yeah. S. So, even when people think they are not eating GMOs.
Oh, I should check my chocolate bars. Oh.
Oh, let's see. There is a non-GMO lecithin for sale made by Now. So that's what we can get, non-GMO.
Uh-huh, right.
Well,
yeah, thank you. Company, yeah.
It, see, costs. Well, that was the gluten that for a long time we couldn't find gluten that was something we could afford. We could find organic gluten. Once we started wanting to buy things that were organic because of the GMO thing.
Right.
I mean, we'd been organic for a long, long time, but some things that you couldn't find organic, we'd get, mm-hmm. you know, like that. And then we decided, well, we're not getting anything that's not organic. And that's when we came up with stuff like having a hard time finding the gluten. And actually, for a couple of years, we couldn't. And then recently, they started offering it at... Yeah, he said there are some products on the market that use lecithin, like chocolate chip cookies, chocolate bars that use organic lecithin.
Hmm. Yeah, because I've seen that because I read all those labels. Yes. And some of them say announce on it, no GMOs in this.
Yes.
And then you know,
So
they say, you know. Although I think there's contamination in organic fields now.
Yes.
Yes.
One thing that it's very difficult to talk about because. Even people who test, they don't want to test because they don't want to find.
To lose their.
Yeah.
How? L. Long. Before. It. Will. Be. Impossible. To. Be. O. R. Organic.
Well, as the hope was that we would just say, okay, it's too late, everything is contaminated. I think it's the same hope with organic. The hope is that that organic agriculture will be so contaminated that we just increase the threshold. You know, the Europeans have kind of started put the lower bid on how what you call non-GMO at about 0.1%. In terms of weight. But, you know, who says that 0.1 is too little or too much over what period of time and so on.
Right.
So how long? I think it's more a question of how can we get it back to where it was before. Because I think it's a fact that it's going to be over.
Can.
All over and is probably already.
Can we get it back to where it was before?
No, but we can prevent it from getting to where it can be.
Well, but the corn and soy are the problems. Mm. Well, corn, soy, cotton, and canola. So far, there's not GMO wheat, although they want that. But a lot of things, most things aren't GMO yet. But if we can push back, I think that the answer is to sue them for contamination. Yeah. So it becomes a real liability when they contaminate people's crops or contaminate organic farmers. So once they start having liability for that, and that's what they're doing in Canada, they're doing a class action suit against Monsanto for contaminating their crops, the canola farmers and the organic farmers up there. So that's one way out. I think that's something they can understand is financial liability. And if the tide can turn, rather than them suing someone whose fields they've contaminated because they're, you know, using their patented gene for those farmers to be able to sue Monsanto for contaminating their fields, if that can start happening, then that'll be they'll stop.
I think that will happen, and I think the industry already has seen it. That's why they divested. You know, Monsanto ain't the same thing that it was in 2000, the beginning of 2000. By the end of 2000, Monsanto was a totally different beast.
Yeah.
All the profitable save, so to speak, you know, chemicals and pharmaceuticals and other things that they were producing were sold out to Pharmacia. And the name Monsanto stayed behind as a shell for all these much riskier things that are obviously a big bet and an uninsurable thing. That's the other people, you know. So the industry has understood it, and the insurance industry has understood it. They will not insure any of these companies or any of these products. There's nobody in the world who will insure it because they know. And again, I want to go back to the Supreme Court of Canada where Percy Schmeisser's case is. That's exactly the turning point, I think. And I think it's going to turn. I really believe it's going to, unless something incredible happens.
Well, but, you know, the Supreme Court of Canada, there's a mouse called the Harvard mouse that they patented that gets cancer, that Harvard developed. And America allowed the patent. The Supreme Court of America allowed the mouse to be patented. And the Supreme Court of Canada did not allow it to be patented. So there are two different ways of looking at that. But, I mean, so Canada, I think they're
the very same Supreme Court who is looking at Percy's case.
Well, two people are new.
Oh, two? I thought it was one.
I think Andrew said there were two.
Okay.
But apparently they were very sympathetic to Percy.
Mm. Yeah.
To Percy's side when they were up there.
S. E. E. Seems like. A. No. Brainer. But. He. L. O. He lost in the L.
In the lower courts?
Lower courts.
But the lower courts just rule on the law, whereas the Supreme Court rules on how it affects society as a whole. It has a wider vision. So they don't go by just, is this the law, or do they, you know, did the patented gene go on his property, but is this a wise thing for society to take the course? So it's actually a really different standard, at least from what I've understood.
Plus, it was a judge, a single individual with no jury, in the local province where Monsanto rules supreme. Mm-hmm. Banks, everything.
And they don't want. I think that the Supreme Court looks at how, you know, these larger issues of not just, you know, what are the laws, but should this be a law, which is.
And they
good.
Already said no to the Harvard mouse.
They said no to the Harvard mouse last couple of years ago.
By saying you should not patent a higher life form. And a higher life form will include, apparently they are explicit about it, a plant and a seed. So I think that's it. Unless something incredible happens, there is no way, there is no logic on how they would rule one way in the Harvard mouse case and another in Percy's case.
So then the issue is when these seeds contaminate people's fields, then can they be held responsible since they're not patenting it and owning it?
So what? I mean, if I have a cow and it breaks the fence and goes into your field, I'm responsible for it. I don't, you know.
Yeah.
After every, before, P, E, R.
Percy.
I. I. T. H. O. I thought. S. D. D. R. I. Drift. Wood. T. A. Take away the P R O profit.
Mm-hmm.
B.
Mm-hmm.
E.
Because
how can you profit from something that is everywhere?
Well, you know, it's yeah, it's like a bad story or a bad dream, but I think what you're saying means you cannot have everybody paying for these royalties. Well, says who? You can. And that's what's happening in Argentina and Brazil now, that Monsanto apparently has the government of Argentina doing the charging. Because you cannot go after every single farmer, they're poor and they, you know, it's just not going to work. They have managed to get the federal government to charge a tax to farmers. And that tax is just turned entirely directly around and paid to Monsanto. So the government is just the fee person for Monsanto. In Brazil, they're doing it through mills or wherever the seed gets concentrated. So you won't get your seed milled unless you pay a surcharge or a tax. And then the miller turns that back into Monsanto. So they don't have to confront the individual, and they own the whole thing. So it's possible. It would be possible. You know, people call it bioserfdom, right? Some people call it.
I was going to use that word too. I'm like, it sounds like people are going to be turned into serfs again.
Mm. Yeah.
Sure.
Absolutely.
That is the U L ultimate G O goal.
I think so.
It's the logical consequence of where we're going. It's expected, and possible.
And I think it's the victory of the machine over the human, because that's what these corporations are. They're just big machines. There's not one person in charge saying, that's not a good idea, let's not do it. No, it's a
D E define machine.
Yeah.
Well, see, I think. No, I've been thinking about this a lot recently. But it's like humans, you know, what we humans can do is make tools. And we make tools in order to create a machine that'll do the work for us. But what's happened now is that the machines, we've created these machines that actually control us. But there's no responsibility with the machine, you know? I mean, with a corporation, there's no real, no one has to take responsibility for it, so you can get away with anything.
And that M A machine was G I given H human rights.
Yeah.
But not human responsibility.
Responsibility, exactly.
That's exactly.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's what we're confronting right now.
Except that there are people who are profiting. There are individuals. There are, it's easy and true that you have the screen of, you know, the shareholders and nobody's really responsible. But there are people who have a house and who have
It's
a pyramid scheme. Like,
but they don't have to take.
Somebody is on the top of that pyramid.
But you don't have to. They don't have to take responsibility. They get all the benefits and none of the responsibility.
No. I wonder what you would think of. There was a very interesting event in, was it 99 or 98? I forget. You know about the Terminator technology.
So it's a
series of pieces of DNA that are inserted in such a way that the seed is made inviable,
so that the farmers can't save their seeds.
Right.
F A R farmers T H R O U through out H history save seeds.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So it was such a critical. It is such a critical. They're still pushing for it, and now they call it GURT, G-U-R-T, genetic use restriction technology. But there
Terminator
was a very interesting.
Such a better name.
Yeah, there was a very interesting event in back a few years where they were, you know, they were really pushing to have this commercialized and introduced into the environment. And the president of the Rockefeller Foundation.
What are the
Terminator
is after a year the seed don't work. He's just explaining to the viewers what the Terminator seed is. Yeah. S.
So you have to buy again.
So you have to buy it again. Yeah. You can't save
that
your seed.
You have to buy again. Yes.
Suicide technology.
Yeah.
Suicide genes.
Traitor genes, all these things.
Traitor.
Yeah.
P-E-R. Percy. S. A. Saved. Seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And. Right, so now they're saying he can't, wasn't that part of it, that he can't use his seeds now?
He can't save his seeds.
Yeah, he destroyed his seeds because they'd been contaminated.
Seeds that he had been producing for 50 years.
U. He. C. R. E. Created. N. New. Seeds.
Yeah.
Is that
he was
right?
He was known in the whole region for his seed improvement, and his wife, they were producing varieties that were adapted to that specific area of Saskatchewan and so on. So they had no interest in being contaminated or ever using Monsanto seed.
That was why he FR freaked out when he found the GMO contamination.
And that's why he's still fighting. I mean, I saw him yesterday, and he's going around the world about this because of that.
He's a real troublemaker.
30 years of work down the drain.
Yeah.
50 years of work down the tubes.
Yeah.
Or maybe three generations, depending on how you see it.
Yeah.
Right.
But then I wanted to go back to the question of agency, of individuals, you know, the guy at the top of the pyramid scheme, or the guy, the Gordon Conway, the president of the Rockefeller Foundation. At that point, when Monsanto is ready to come out with the Terminator technology on the market, like they call it, which I call it in public, public environment, he went to the board of directors and he said, I don't think so. This is really not something that is going to work. I mean, this is Rockefeller Foundation that had been almost single-handedly pushing for this since the 1930s. I wonder what people think about that, whether there is really agency to say no. And he stopped it. He leaked his letter to the media, and it was wrong. And that's the reason why we don't have it yet. Well, not only that, but many...
They... N E never like L light shone on them.
Yeah, of course.
Well, the United States government is the co-owner of the Terminator gene.
USDA. Yeah.
USDA is the co-owner of the Terminator gene. Technology of the technology. That's a horrifying thought. Unbelievable.
And we own.
Yeah, right. Our and government.
We own the USDA.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. In reality.
Yes. Yeah. But there is a P-O, no, there is a O, other, L-E, L-E-G, leg, of this, S-T, story, U, G got canned.
Canned.
I got canned.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Let's talk about that.
Using can in a different way. Yeah.
Not yet.
You were denied tenure so far?
So far, yes.
So far. And does one get tenure by unanimous vote, or
no? The university has never been a democratic organization. Mm-hmm. It's more like a monastery, so it's a monastic decision that is taken eventually by the top monk, you know, by the mm-hmm. chancellor, and he can do whatever he wants. He can, you know,
override what everybody. May say.
It's in his attribution to do that. The trouble in my case, for good fortune, for whatever reason, is that it's incredibly clean. It's unusually clean in my case, in the sense that they spent, and I've estimated this. I've built a chronology of this, and they spent 73.2% of the time of the process, which has taken almost 3 years, where it normally would take 6 months, 5 months.
This is the process.
The process of evaluation, of the case, of my case. Yeah.
For your tenure.
So 73% of that time, which is unusually long, was spent fishing for someone who could possibly say no, and recommend that they don't give me tenure. Some way of justifying a decision, and they couldn't possibly come up with anything. They kept getting positives.
Darn,
exactly. Exactly. Just kept getting green light and green light and green light. Secret committees, two secret committees who could have said no, unanimously said yes. Then there is a phone call or something we know now from the administration to the chair of one of those committees saying we need a different answer. And the guy says, well, I don't think I'm going to do that. The whole thing just falls apart. Well, they still go out seeking negative letters. They got one. It took them 18 letters before they could get one of somebody. Now it seems to be someone who is paid by industry, who hates me, etc. I mean, you eventually find someone who will do that. And that is the whole basis for saying no. So we're fighting like hell.
That's what they said. We want a different answer.
I don't know the words.
I don't know the words,
but they called him to say, you need to go and find other source of references, other sources of evidence for this, and you need to re-review the case.
S. So, why?
Why what? Why fight?
Why did they give us a reason to deny him tenure?
Why can he? Why?
Why? Was and what S T A R T started it?
Well, your stand against the
money. Yeah. I used to work. I worked for the industry. I worked for Sandoz that became Novartis in Switzerland. So when I came here,
T R A I traitor.
Yeah.
No, scientist. Curious person.
yeah, look at it that way if you want. It's
but he's not, Ignacio's not totally against that. I mean, that's why you have to bring a stronger case to it, I think.
The S-A-M, the same thing in their B in their book. It's the same thing in their book.
Who can take revenge? Because it's not individuals. It's not about revenge, I don't think. It's not about being a traitor. It's whether you're a problem that needs to be surgically removed. I think it's more that than just sheer revenge. I think there are people who, of course, hate me for giving them trouble, but I don't think that's enough. At some point recently, I thought they had given me for dead. You know, there's been an incredible campaign of discreditation. The Guardian in Manchester found out that it had been paid but at least partly by Monsanto. It had been run by this huge PR company using viral marketing through the internet, creating fake names to spread information, you know, misinformation about my work and my person and my student. My student is a bioterrorist for many people. And you know what that means these days, to be, you know, labeled a terrorist and so on. So I thought they would have given us for dead. But apparently not. Apparently we still mean trouble. And I think it has to do with what you were saying before, Frank, that they recognize that it's individuals, that it's, you know, people who can look into your eye and say, and ask a question that count. That's kind of... hopeful.
Yeah, it is hopeful.
AI, ain't it FLA?
Yes, it is flattering. It is flattering and it is hopeful.
H-E hell L Helms I investigated, Senator Jesse Helms investigated Frank a number of times trying to, he had the General Accounting Office investigating Frank a few times in the early 90s to try to make a case that Frank was an obscene artist. And Frank wasn't even getting money from the government. It didn't, you know, it wasn't like anything like that. They were just, you know, I got one. He had gotten an NEA fellowship one time, years before all that, and we didn't like the feel of that, you know, the dependency on money from someplace else, so that was the end of that. And so this was just, you know, we had been supporting our own art for the rest of the time. Yeah.
What doesn't that also, apart from being flattering, doesn't it also make you, when you actually see the gut of the thing, when you actually see what it's made of, you realize how vulnerable it is, too.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And
built on fragile, the fragile concept that, you know, people really don't talk to each other. People really don't get together and get a feel for where somebody's coming from.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's an assumption.
Yeah, it's an assumption.
M. O. Most. T A R targeted artists were very unhappy about being targeted and you know some changed their art so they would because the clubs that were booking them were the ones that would lose because they wouldn't get their government funding if they booked targeted artists and but Frank, I mean, this was like, Frank loved it. He had so much fun. So much fun. He was writing things. They were getting published every place. You know, and he would say to his fellow artists, he would say, you know, he'd say, I'm flexible. You know, this is my art now then. This is, you know, right. They were saying it's keeping me away from my art. You know, this is my art now.
Right.
They, G, got, B, you burned out after a a year of dealing with it, they got burned out and didn't.
Who, the artists?
The artists after
who
a year.
Took that attitude.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So you take the attitude. This is how I do art. That's so interesting. That's why you're alive. And I'm trying to do that myself. And saying, I'm going to do science in the court. Mm. What I'm doing is doing science about this other. I'm a biologist, and I study this being, that's this organism, an institution, and how it's made, and how it works, and how it behaves. And it's fun. It's just interesting. And you do it in the lab, or you do it in the court, or you do it, I don't know, wherever it takes you.
X, exactly. Yes.
Wherever it takes you, right?
And yes.
And people call it politics sometimes, and people will call it different things. Same thing.
And why don't you take no for an answer?
Right.
That's what Frank gets a lot. Why don't you take no for an answer?
They tell you that?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I took no for an answer, I would not be here now.
Right. You wouldn't be alive. Yeah.
You did PERF perform MAN
performance
A art.
You know, it's funny.
Sure.
it's an incredible. That is flattering. That is flattering. And I've gotten that from a few performance artists who started just becoming interested in what I was doing, sitting outside the chancellor's office, or what I was doing, trashing an artist party that they were having at the Berkeley Art Museum, or you know, what I was doing a webcast that I think you guys covered.
Yes,
they started becoming
right.
interested in that, and that is flattering. That is very flattering. That's really flattering.
You H E held your office hours outside the Chancellor's building.
That
this
was
for
an
people
experience.
Who don't know. And what was it, like 4 days or three?
5 days and five nights, I counted.
He set up his desk right outside the Chancellor's office. Yeah.
That was a fantastic time. It was after the first half hour of really dry mouth and fear of, you know, standing there with my donkey's ears. Because I couldn't tell anybody until, you know, midnight. That was my break point. But word started leaking out that I was going to do it. I couldn't tell because I knew that they would do something to stop me from doing it. So I sent an email at 3:30 in the morning, and I came out at 6. At 6:30, by 7 o'clock, they were there already with a new contract. And I said, so I guess you expect me to go back in. And they go like that. I said, I'm sorry.
But what was your demand in sitting there?
It was not demand. It was not demand. What happened was that I was still being evaluated after 2 years and some.
For his tenure.
For my tenure. And my contract was going to run out. I was on a terminal contract. So at some point I realized, oh my God, you know, next week I'm not going to be a professor at Berkeley. I'm not going to have a job. But that doesn't matter too much. I better do it. So I went out, and my position was, I'm going to do what I'm supposed to be doing 24 hours a day publicly. On front of this bunker of a place where the chancellor, the administration, and the people who, you know, the powers that be, hide. We had a fantastic, maybe this is one anecdote that I'd really like. The one one guard, a very old man from the library, would come out at night and just sit with us, because there were people there 24 hours a day, and he would sit with us. And one night he told us this story, the story of the University of California, the story of the state, all around the moment when they took the doorknob out of California Hall, you know, the neural center of the university, which means the moment where people could not open that door from the outside, where they stonewalled inside that bunker. Oh. It was such a fantastic idea, and that really summarized the whole problem. These guys are hiding from light. These guys are hiding from the public. These guys are hiding from what the university is supposed to be doing. So the position was, we're going to bring light in whatever little space that we have. So we ended up, for example, projecting against the wall of California Hall. As soon as dark came, we started projecting whatever people wanted to do, and there were really great things there. All just on that theme. That's why the media wasn't really able to handle it, because they came immediately and they wanted to have, you know, why? What's your demand? And what would it take to get you back into your office?
Yes.
Nothing.
A. S. O. A sound bite.
Yeah. Right. They wanted a sound bite and they didn't get it. So we got food. There was a lot of politics of food going on. Anyway, I could talk for a long time about that.
It, they, F, they have, V, E, very, L, I, they have very little power, O, out, side, of, the, B, O, box.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's I think it's absurd to respond in their terms.
N, E, never.
Right.
That is when U, L, O, lose.
Right. Right.
Right. And they are very S, C, scared. P, E, people. Will, F, figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fear.
I. H. A. I had a P E R performance S series at UC Berkeley for almost a full year. I think it was like 8 or 9 months. Every other week a student group had gotten us a room on the campus, so it was free. You know, we didn't pay anything, people didn't pay to come. But at first we had a professor at the in the performance art or painting, I forget, department. They always forget how, why they don't want me around.
Right. So you have to remind them.
That's right. That's his job. I S L slip. I slip in every 7 or 8 years everywhere. You slip in everywhere. So she was. There were at least two teachers in different departments teaching about Frank, and then she started inviting him to be a guest teacher, you know, and he'd get paid to go. And this was like a really good gig, right?
Wow.
And so he always pushes. So, and I get the ST students. Right. He would, get them all fired up. Yeah. He mm-hmm. would get the students mm-hmm. all fired up. And so we asked the teacher at one point, would she sponsor a series for him to do a performance art series at the university at some at her WEA week PO point. You got her at her weak point, at a weak moment. So she said yes, she would look into what was involved, and she did. And so we had it all set up. We had, like, you know, 10 dates for a semester. I did it in the 1980s. Frank had a series for 3.5 years mm-hmm. at the university. The same deal. Mm-hmm. So ever wow. since then, he's kind of, it was so perfect, you know, to have that kind of situation that he's been looking for a way to get it again ever since. And so here he saw his opportunity. And so she it was all arranged and everything. And then the East Bay Express did a cover story on us that came out the week of the first performance. And it was, we were on the cover, big picture, me nude, standing next to Frank. And then all throughout the article were pictures from our performances with nudity. And they ran, like, a lot of pictures and stuff. And so, you know, all over the Bay Area, on the streets, you can see it. We were, like, impressed with them, yeah, you know, that yeah, they yeah. did that. It was a good article. And apparently the head of the department saw the article and said, we're sponsoring what? And said,
really?
No. Yeah. Said, that's not the word she gave. That she didn't tell us that, but the other person we knew that was in another department said the chairperson of the department that canceled it called him the DF. The first performance was P. A
packed.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we were really blown out because it was like, it was almost like we were just vehicles. People were like so right. into this event, whatever this represented, and no L I limits.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So after that first performance, we get an email from her saying she's sorry, but it turns out she didn't understand what she had to do to sponsor it, and it requires her to be there every performance, and she can't do it, so that's it. So it's cool. Canceled. Well, yeah. So we actually had a friend in that department who said, I'll go to all the performances if somebody has to be there.
Oh.
And very rudely she responded, Frank, it's over. I don't want to talk about it. Don't contact me anymore. And so that's when we talked to our other friend who said, well, you know, she's actually not telling you the truth because the chairman of that department called me. And he didn't want you there. They were very uncomfortable with it. And so we said, hey, well, why don't you sponsor it then? You know, because he had been a guest on the show complaining how they have all this empty space at the university that nobody uses. And in New York, there would be artists using those spaces. So we said, hey, you know. He said, well, you know, you should get a student to sponsor it because they have less to lose.
Huh. They have less to lose? Is that what
that's what
said?
He said. They have less to lose.
It would be incredible if it wasn't so true and so common.
Mm. Yes. So we actually had, when we had been fighting the city of Berkeley because they were trying to censor Frank's public access shows, we went to a lot of meetings at the city council, and there was a young doctorate student a Frank Moore law. They had the city attorney write just to so that Frank
that is
showed,
flattering.
That's very flattering. Couldn't air. First they tried before 2 a.m. and then they backed it off to midnight. It was just our show and the show that we sponsor that would fall under this law. And
what I'm sorry, I'm so ignorant. But what is the problem? Nudity? Is that all?
Well, let's see. For this particular thing, for the city council, well, the performances, I could just say what, you know, I don't really know. There's, I mix everything up. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We think like, you know, Frank has often said if I did like straight sex erotic, people would have less problems with it. But, you know, there's a lot of things. He, like, you know, has coined words to describe physical play between adults that's not sex but has no limits. And he talks about how that's, like, a normal communication that people lose when they leave childhood. And so, you know, he kind of throws that kind of thing in with silly things. It's just, like, everything. Everything gets, you know, the ultimate variety show, he often says. INTER interview. Yeah, interviews. NU nudity. ER erotic. Yeah. BA bands playing P.O. poetry. That's the show that they were trying to ban. So
that's incredible.
I mean, like, we had mayoral candidates and Chris Worthington, and, you know, we've had, it's just really a spectrum of stuff. D.I.V. Diverse. It's diverse. Yeah.
Now people don't like being disoriented.
Yes. Yes.
That's frightening.
Yeah. So we found a student who we had met at one of those city council meetings who got very he won in the city council. They dropped the law. They didn't pass.
Oh, the law didn't pass?
Mm-mm. He had it was covered by the AP press. Frank wrote a lot of letters and got a lot. That's the thing about they don't like light.
Mm-hmm.
He was the top story on Channel 7 News one night.
Oh.
So, you know, he had the ACLU there. And, you know, so it just disappeared. They had one vote where it passed, and then they have to have a second vote.
Oh.
Just disappeared. No one ever brought it up again.
Right.
The F I. The first version, the first vote, we lost. Yeah, everybody voted for this law except for Chris Worthington. Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, we did end up doing the series at UC Berkeley through a student group.
With a student group.
Yeah.
Yeah, I should. I have a daughter waiting for me who needs to go to school tomorrow. So
we ready to wrap? Can we SH show your F film? On Lover?
Not yet, because first we have to try to get it on regular TV and put it in film festivals, and we have to do all our activist stuff. But after that, maybe
what
after
is it
several...
Called?
It's called The Future of Food.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Your name is Deborah Garcia,
because
we didn't say that.
Yeah, and then down the road it'll be. But first we want to try to, kind of maximize it out there in the real world.
Yeah.
And they like to feel like they're the first, you know, so so we'll see how that goes.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're all going to end up being very strange mutants if we keep eating this stuff.
Well, hopefully we can keep eating organic for quite some time.
And Ignacio Chapella. Am I saying your name right?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. It's been great.
It's been really nice.
Really very good.
Thank you,
nice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great meeting you.
Really nice meeting you, too.
Yes.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, your player will stop. Hit play again. This is Lover.